On today's program, social change artist Parker J. Palmer and the spirit of his message. I'm Richard Brendan, and we're bringing love to life. Welcome to the program. We the people need to find the courage to create a politics worthy of the human spirit. At this critical time in American life, Parker J. Palmer, best-selling author, thought leader, teacher, activist, and founder of the Center for Courage and Renewal, brings us a powerful and stimulating new book, Healing the Heart of Democracy, The Courage to Create a Politics Worthy of the Human Spirit. Democracy, writes Palmer, is a nonstop experiment in the strengths and weaknesses of our political institutions, local communities, and the human heart. The experiment is endless unless we blow up the lab and the explosives to do the job are found within us. But so also is the heart's alchemy that can turn suffering into compassion, conflict into community, and tension into energy for creativity amid democracy's demands. Parker J. Palmer has written many books, actually nine, including the bestsellers The Courage to Teach, Let Your Life Speak, and A Hidden Wholeness. His writing has been recognized with 10 honorary doctorates and numerous national awards. He's the founder and senior partner at the Center for Courage and Renewal, and he holds a PhD from the University of California at Berkeley. And Parker joins us from his home in beautiful Madison, Wisconsin. Parker, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Good to be with you, Richard.
Well, thank you so much. You know, this is a critical moment in American life. And the statistics I read actually today were alarming. I found out that 1 in 6 are living in poverty in this country, and that 50 million people are uninsured now in this country. And civility in Washington is probably at an all-time low. When you wrote this book, you said this was also the most challenging book you ever wrote. So let's start there. Why was it the most challenging for you?
Well, I think the answer is partly personal and partly professional. Mm-hmm. I started writing this book in 2004, and as I explain in the prelude, it was a point in my own journey. I was 65 in 2004 when I found myself overwhelmed with some darkness about what was going on in America politically, and then eventually found myself sinking deeper into a full-blown clinical depression. And as I say in the prelude, it's my third time down as an adult with depression, and so I obviously have some sort of propensity toward it, but I'm not ready to write this particular experience of darkness off as merely genetics or brain chemistry. I think sometimes the human heart is like the canary in the coal mine that senses the toxicity in the culture and begins to die a little, and I think that was happening to me in 2004, 2005. So writing, first of all, an essay called The Politics of the Brokenhearted, which eventually grew into this book, Healing the Heart of Democracy, was, for me as a writer, one way of sort of creatively engaging with the issues that I found so depressing, and also engaging, re-engaging as a citizen of this society. Professionally, it was a challenging book to write, and it did take me 7 years to write it. I'm 72 now, because it's a very complex subject. It's not only a complex set of problems we face, but to write the book well, which I hope I did, others will have to be the judge of that, I needed to do a lot of studying of American history, of the processes of democracy and the history of democracy, of the best data on the current situation, and, as you know, at the same time, maintain my inward focus on the dynamics of the human heart, the habits of the heart that are so critical to democracy. So I think that's why it was a challenging book to write.
It's interesting that it took 7 years, because when you really think about it, and the book just came out now is the perfect time for this book, given what's going on and the statistics that I shared a few minutes ago.
Well, I've had a number of people say that to me, and, you know, part of my reaction is that's dumb luck on a writer's part. The other part of my reaction is how sad that we keep sinking on some of these critical indicators. One of the saddest statistics that I've seen is that roughly a quarter of American children are suffering from some level of hunger. Mm-hmm. In this affluent society, that's simply unacceptable. Mm-hmm. And we seem, at certain levels of our democracy, we seem to have lost our compassion and our caring and our capacity to act on these things. But the book, as you know, is not about those people in Washington. I think we have plenty of talking heads on cable television and in the newspapers talking to us about those people in Washington. The focus of the book is on where I find hope and promise, which is on we the people, mm-hmm. who called this democracy into being, and in whom I have a lot of belief. It's so interesting that when you ask people to talk about politics, they immediately turn to certain kind of global images of the national scene, and they get either angry or very depressed. When you ask them to talk about local community, people helping each other, neighborliness, and things of this sort, the scene is much more uplifting, mm-hmm. and people have much more sense of empowerment about what they can do for each other and what they are doing for each other.
Mm-hmm. In the beginning of the book, this book is written in memory of various children as, I think, a powerful reminder of what you just said. It's not about Washington. It's about us. It's about we the people. Can you talk a little bit about who these children represent?
Yeah. In the dedication to the book, I wrote at a time, I wrote the last chapter of the mm-hmm. book when the terrible shooting happened down in Tucson. The target, of course, was Congresswoman Gabrielle Giffords and a young girl named Christina Taylor Green was killed at age, as I recall, 8 or 9. I can't remember exactly. And so she was a victim of certainly a person who's now been determined to be a psychopath. But at the same time, it seems to me there's a continuum of violence, and when we encourage violent talk about politics, we also run the risk of spilling blood over something that should be a matter of citizen discourse and debate. So the book is dedicated to Christina Taylor Green, 2001-2011, and then to four young teenage women who were 13 or 14 years old, girls, Addie Mae Collins, Denise McNair, Carol Robertson, and Cynthia Wesley. I don't know how many people remember those names, but they were the young African-American girls who died in 1963 when members of the Klan bombed the 16th Street Baptist Church in Birmingham, Alabama. Mm. And shortly before finishing the book and deciding on the dedication, I went on the civil rights pilgrimage led by Representative John Lewis from Georgia. And one of the stops we made as we visited Birmingham, Montgomery, and then Selma, where we marched across the bridge again as they did on Bloody Sunday all those years ago, we made a stop at the 16th Street Baptist Church. I saw the site where these young girls were killed, and all of this was very much on my heart and my mind as I brought the book to a conclusion. Mm-hmm. And as I say in the dedication, and I'll just quote it briefly, when we forget that politics is about weaving a fabric of compassion and justice on which everyone can depend, the first to suffer are the most vulnerable among us. our children, the elderly, the mentally ill, the poor, and the homeless. And as they suffer, so does the integrity of our democracy. May the heartbreaking deaths of these children and the hope and promise that was in their young lives help us find the courage to create a politics worthy of the human spirit.
It's an honor to have Parker J. Palmer as a guest on today's program, best-selling author, teacher, founder of Center for Courage and Renewal. We're talking about his brand new book, Healing the Heart of Democracy, The Courage to Create a Politics Worthy of the Human Spirit. I'm Richard Brendan.
Hello, Indiana. This is Dr. Laura Merrifield Wilson, host of Positively Politics. I'd like to invite you to join our conversation on the current issues and events in politics with the experts who know them best. Every Saturday morning here on WICR at 11:30, we break down the sometimes negative and often complicated world of politics in a nonpartisan, straightforward, and educationally rooted way. You won't want to miss the discussion on Positively Politics Saturday morning at 11:30 right here on The Diamond.
This is Dave Baghdad, host of The Kitchen Party Kaylee. I hope you'll join me every Sunday at 10 p.m. for the best music from Ireland, Scotland, Canada, and the U.S. The Kitchen Party Kaylee, Celtic music from across the globe and across town.
Welcome back to the program. My guest is Parker J. Palmer. We're talking about his newest book, The Healing, The Heart of Democracy. Parker, you talked in the first segment about your journey with depression. And during that time, there was a book called Lincoln's Melancholy. I don't know if our listeners fully are aware of the journey of depression. Perhaps our greatest president suffered most of his life.
Yes, and as you know, Richard, that book proved very helpful to me in kind of connecting the dots between my personal experience and some of my political struggles at the time I began writing. So the book called Lincoln's Melancholy is written by Joshua Schenck, Joshua Wolf Schenck, and it's a really remarkable book about the fact that Abraham Lincoln, from a very young age, his late teens or early 20s, suffered from clinical depression. It was called melancholy in those days. And he continued to suffer from that throughout his life. The point that Schenck makes that I think is such a powerful point is that in order to preserve his own life, in order to stay, to follow his calling, because Lincoln always felt he had a high political calling in life, he wanted to serve his nation and his community in some significant way. Mm-hmm. But to stay on his own two feet to do that, he had to do what everyone who suffers from depression has to do, which is to integrate the shadow and the light within ourselves. You can't sweep that darkness under the rug. You can't pretend it didn't happen. You can't ignore it or deny it. You have to find a way to say, I am both darkness and light, and if I can learn to do a co-creative dance between those two forces within me, then I can become whole, what psychologists call integration of the self. And Schenck traces a fascinating history in which Lincoln worked away at that integration, not with medication, but with poetry, with humor, with literature, with all kinds of dedication. And so Schenck makes the point that having reconciled these two warring forces in himself, let me use a different image, knowing that he contained within himself both the good guys and the bad guys, and having learned to do a dance between those two, he was the perfect president to reconcile a warring nation, where another president might have said, here are the good guys, and there are the bad guys, and I'm going to split this nation right down the middle even further than it's split. Lincoln instead took this very reconciling position in which he was saying things like, look, God isn't on either side of this, neither side can claim God's blessing on what they're doing. What we need to do is get right with God, and we need to get right with each other. He said that in more eloquent ways, but he said it frequently, and he said it courageously. And it was, I think, one of the reasons for his assassination. He was dedicated to holding the pieces together. But Schenck makes the point that if you haven't had to do that inner work of integration, if you don't know yourself as both the good guys and the bad guys, then you're going to move in the external world, separating people into the sheep and the goats. Mm-hmm. And here are my friends and here are my enemies. Not a good place for a political leader to be. So for me, it became a personal question, which was, how can I use this experience of darkness and my own ongoing efforts to integrate this in myself to become, not a political leader, that's not my calling, but a person who in his own work of writing and teaching and of being a citizen, being a neighbor, how can I use this ongoing inner work of integration to hold more generously and more generatively all the conflicts around me, all the either-ors, all that I might, if I didn't stop to understand it, that I might want to split into the good guys and the bad guys. That turned out to be a question around which I've tried, and I think to some extent I have grown in the last 7 years through the writing of this book.
I was fascinated to read a portion of Lincoln's speech, actually when he was 28 years old. It was in January 1838. And one of the things he said was, at what point, then, is the approach of danger to be expected within the country? He said, I answer, if it ever reaches us, it must spring up amongst us. Mm-hmm. It cannot come from abroad.
Right. He was very, very clear that the destruction of American democracy was not going to happen at the hands of some foreign power, but it was going to happen if we went at each other tooth and claw, trying to rip out each other's hearts and throats, and, of course, then presided over the bloodiest war we've ever fought, in which Americans killed each other to the number of maybe 750,000, pretty close to 750,000 anyway.
Mm-hmm.
And at a very young age, as you say, I don't remember the exact figure, but I think that was 15 years at least before the Civil War was fought. Lincoln is seeing that the real danger to American democracy is what some people have called the enemy within. And I would want to put that on two levels, as I do in the book. It's partly about neighbor against neighbor, brother against brother, Republicans against Democrats, the people who think they're totally right against the folks they know are totally wrong. And that's one level of the enemy within, that kind of divisiveness and the various forms of violence that come out of it. But deeper still, there is an enemy within which sort of lurks in our own hearts. And I think that's, the hardest one to shed light on and to try to bring into one's, bring into the light so that one can deal with it, so that one can heal it wherever that's coming from, and so that one can be in the world as a life-giving person rather than a death-dealing person.
Yes.
It is, of course, the agenda of every great spiritual tradition to do what I was just talking about, to deal with that enemy within and to turn from hatred and anger and fear toward love. I think, love is a big word, and I don't think it's always the best word to use politically. It works better in interpersonal relationships, But something, you know, when we talk about seeking the common good, we're talking about a political form of love. Do I care about my neighbor? Do I care about my neighbor's well-being? Do I understand that I stand on the contributions of a lot of other people, namely fellow members of my civic community, and I owe them something back? And am I willing to contribute to the common good out of that understanding? Or do I entertain the fantasy that I did this all myself, and I'll just keep grabbing anything I can, and the devil take the hindmost as far as other people are concerned?
Yes. My guest today is Parker J. Palmer, writer, teacher, activist. We're talking about his new book, Healing the Heart of Democracy. I'm Richard Brendan. We'll be right back after a short break. Welcome back to the program. My guest today is Parker J. Palmer. His new book is out, Healing the Heart of Democracy. Parker, in the book you talk about how just as we have neglected our physical infrastructure in this country, roads, bridges, and there's been a lot of talk about that these days, we've also, and probably more importantly, neglected democracy's infrastructure. You talk about an ecosystem. What is that for you?
Right. Well, let's I guess I have several images going in the book that you've identified very accurately. Let me focus for a moment on that infrastructure image and maybe talk about the ecosystem a little bit later. So you're absolutely right. Physical infrastructure is much in the news these days. A bridge falls down in Minneapolis and carries some people to their deaths. Streets explode in New York. You know, we all know we've been neglecting our roads and what's under the streets for way too long, and we're paying a price for that. But there is also an infrastructure to democracy itself, and I believe that the quickest way to identify that is to say the infrastructure is all of the local venues in which we live and move and have our being. I'm thinking of the family, of the neighborhood, of the classroom, of the workplace, of religious congregations of various sorts, of the public spaces where we meet as what I call the company of strangers. So these are all kind of microcosmic places where, you know, we're not in Washington, D.C. We are in our own hometowns. We're not in the halls of Congress, but we are in classrooms and families and religious communities and so forth. And we are either forming or deforming our hearts. The heart, the habits of the heart that make for good citizenship either get formed or not in those places. And so it's a two-level infrastructure of these venues of local life where our habits of the heart get formed, and then, deeper still, those habits of the heart themselves. I'll just say a quick word about where that phrase, habits of the heart, comes from. This country, when it was very young, in the 1830s, was visited by a very remarkable young Frenchman, 27 years old at the time, named Alexis de Tocqueville. And he was here for less than a year and went home to France to write what is, I think, still probably the best book ever written on American democracy called Democracy in America. And one of his great insights in the 1830s was that the future of democracy, which he very much wanted to survive, the future of democracy would depend on the habits of the heart that its citizens developed. Would they, for example, develop a habit of radical individualism, mm-hmm. of you know, everybody grabbing whatever they can and forgetting about their neighbors? Or would they develop a habit of communalism, where they understood a shared responsibility toward one another? And he saw a kind of struggle going on in a very young America in 1835 between those two habits of the heart. And he said the answer to the question is going to depend very much on what happens in those local venues of life that I just named. And he was particularly interested in school classrooms and in religious congregations, which, as you know, I have a chapter about in the book, because the second half of the book really is, well, what can we do about all this, and where can we do it? So Alexis de Tocqueville is a good, I think, he's pointing in a very important direction, that we need in all those local venues of life pay attention once again to the habits of the heart that make democracy possible. And if we don't do that, the same thing is going to happen to democracy as has been happening to the physical features of this society. We're going to have bridges falling down and streets exploding because we neglect infrastructure. So what is it that can be done in classrooms? What is it that can be done in neighborhoods? What is it that can be done in families and religious communities to help form our hearts rather than deform them in the habits that make democracy possible?
You list five habits of the heart. One of the habits is an appreciation of the value of otherness. Now, if one were to look at the media, whether it be internet, TV, radio, newspaper, what have you, you'd get the idea that we're not doing very well in that. But you also talk about how the media can unfairly influence our perceptions of what's taking place.
Absolutely. I think that, you know, I have a chapter that basically sort of asks the question, where are we getting our information? And what happens in the mass media, and I make a real distinction between... common sense distinction, but let's make a very important distinction between CNN, which you see at the airport, with one story being talked about by the news anchor and 100 other stories running by on a ticker tape at the bottom of the screen. The distinction between that kind of mass media and the kind of media you're involved with, where we have the chance to have an in-depth conversation about things that matter. Two different forms of media. It's pretty clear which one I value more. But what happens in the mass media is that the issues in our society get portrayed in such quick sound bites and almost cartoon style, the mass media are always going for shock value because they know it sells, it grabs our attention. And they present things at such a high, such a generalized and abstract level that we live in this unreal world of images and caricatures that have very little to do with the way that things happen in real life. So here's a concrete example. Mm-hmm. If you look at the mass media and how they portray, let us say, that very small minority of Muslims who have embraced violence as a way of responding to their life situation, a very small minority of Muslims have embraced violence that way. But if you look at the presentation of that in the media, it looks as if Muslim equals violence. There's very little subtlety about their presentation, and you begin to understand why so many, why too many Americans believe in that equation and ignore the fact that there's also a small minority of Christians who believe in violence mm-hmm. and do violence to each other. Let's then take it down to the local level, where the person I'm working with day in and day out, or the person, my neighbor from whom I borrow tools, is a Muslim. And I don't have those images or those caricatures about that person because I know him or her as a human being. That kind of local knowledge forms the heart in a constructive, life-giving way, where our mass media deform the heart, which is what always happens when we live off of cartoons and caricatures and short attention span theater, rather than really looking at reality and really looking at the particularity of another human being mm-hmm. who is precious in and for his or her own sake.
Well, you're speaking of the need for community. You know, there's a lot of talk and a lot of discussion about social media. It was interesting to read in your book, you cited an article, I think, that Malcolm Gladwell, who's a gifted writer, a futurist, I think, who was really making a case that really against that in a way.
Yeah, I think Gladwell was, he wrote this piece about the lunch counter sit-ins mm-hmm. among
yes.
students in the 1960s. And he says he was writing at a moment in our fast-paced public conversation, such as it is, when folks were saying, look at what the social media can do to foment revolutionary change, positive revolutionary change, as in the Arab Spring, for example.
Mm-hmm.
We've read all these stories about how Facebook and Twitter and so forth helped bring people together and in these authoritarian societies and generated collective power that overthrew tyrants. And he's basically saying, well, if you look closely at real sustained social movements, they have much more to do with what I think he calls thick ties or bonds or
yes.
relationships, which are face-to-face and interpersonal,
mm-hmm.
as of the sort that animated those lunch counter sit-ins in the South in the 60s, much more to do with that than with tweeting messages or posting things on Facebook. Well, what I basically say in the book, because he was then criticized, set himself over against a guy named Clay Shirky, who wrote a book about the power of technology to enhance democracy. And I actually think the right response to that debate is to say you're both right. that everything is about balance and discernment and what's needed at a particular time. Our personal relationships and personal bonds and loyalty to each other critical to a social movement? Absolutely so. We need to break bread together, as they did in the civil rights movement. We need to have each other's back. We need to know each other well enough to care for one another. At the same time, is it possible to animate that kind of action, to quicken it, to spread it more widely among people, to spread those possibilities more widely among people by use of the social media? Absolutely. I don't see it as an either-or. And, at age 72, I'm of that generation that was very skeptical about the rise of cyber technology when it began. I remember clearly arguing with a couple of friends who were into computers before I was, and I said, look, I've already written four books on a typewriter. Why do I need a computer? And today, of course, I wouldn't know what to do without a computer has really facilitated my writing. But more than that, it has allowed me to engage in public conversations that I would not have been able to have 20 years ago. Now, it's very important for me to keep to remember, and at my age, with my experience, it's easy to remember that these online conversations are really different from sitting in a circle with 20 people late into the night and trying to understand a problem and trying to connect profoundly with one another and trying to decide on what we're going to do next. Those are two different things. But I don't see them as an either or, and I think they can be mutually co-creative.
My guest today is Parker J. Palmer. We're talking about his newest book, Healing: The Heart of Democracy. We'll have more right after this break.
This is Jürgen Jungbauer from the Heidelberg House on Pendleton Pike here in Indianapolis. Join me this Sunday for German Music Hour. And even if you don't speak the language, I hope you enjoy the music and the rhythm and the beat on this radio station every Sunday at 1 o'clock. It's only here on 88.7 WICR.
No alarm clock. No traffic to negotiate. No staff meetings to attend. Sunday is your day, so do yourself a favor. Tune out all that noise and tune in for Sunday Baroque.
Sunday morning from 5 to 9 here on 88.7 WICR.
Welcome back to the program. It's a joy to have Parker J. Palmer, best-selling author, teacher, and founder of Center for Courage and Renewal. We're talking about his book, Healing the Heart of Democracy. One of the habits you also listed that I think is so important, and I'd like to get your take on how we can begin to do that much better than what we are, and that's cultivating the ability to hold a tension in life-giving ways.
Right. That is, as you know, I have five habits of the heart, and that's the one that's right in the middle, because I think it has a very central place in our lives. Let me use a really homey example, which I use at some point in the book, about cultivating the ability to hold tension in life-giving ways. That can sound like a big deal. That can sound like sort of abstract and overly intellectual. But anyone who has ever attempted to raise a teenager knows what holding tension in a life-giving way is all about. It's something that good parents do day in and day out. You look at your child, the typical teenager who's still very much forming a sense of self, and is making some bad choices as he or she goes along, and many do, just as my generation did. You, as a parent, you see the gift, the potentiality, the possibility within that child of yours that you love, and you have to hold a tension creatively between what's actually happening in that child's life and what you believe to be possible in that child's life. Couples in any sort of loving relationship have to hold those tensions creatively, because they don't always see eye to eye. But it's not a good relationship if one person holds all the power and makes all the decisions and simply tells the other person to shut up or give it up when they want to go someplace that the power holder doesn't. So I think we know how to hold tension in ways that are life-giving. And one of the big images, as you know, that I have running through this book, because I think it's critical to habits of the heart, is that when we hold these tensions, the tension between what is what's real on the one hand, mm-hmm. what we see around us, and what we, on the other hand, what we know to be possible and desirable. Not a fantasy, not a wish dream, but something we've seen with our own eyes that's better than the reality we've got. If you faithfully hold that tension, it's going to break your heart. Heartbreak is a big image in this book. But there are two ways for the heart to break. And I think most of us have experience of both these ways. One is that it can shatter into 1,000 pieces, and we can spend the rest of our lives on our hands and knees crawling around trying to pick the pieces up and put the heart back together. That's what happens when the heart is brittle. It breaks in the common sense use of that word break. But there's another way for the heart to break that is also within our human experience, and that is for it to break open into greater capacity to hold all of the hope and all of the suffering in the world and in our own lives. And again, I'll use a commonplace example. We all know, and perhaps we've experienced it in our own lives, but we know someone who has lost to death someone very dear to them.
Mm-hmm.
We know what we all go through a period of grieving when we think that life isn't worth living without this person. We're lost. We're bereft. We are in deep darkness. But I have heard so many people say, as they begin to emerge from that first phase of grieving, my heart has been opened to a new largeness. I'm more compassionate. I'm more engaged with life. I'm more appreciative. I'm more grateful. Because everything I now see and feel is through the lens of this loss. And rather than it having shattered my life, it's opened my life. Well, I believe that the politics of rage, as we call it these days, is in fact the politics of the brokenhearted for the most part.
Mm-hmm.
I think the more you love something, the angrier you're going to be about its loss, but that what's really underneath the anger is heartbreak at the loss of that which you love. That seems to me to be, again, sort of common sense, observable stuff. And I'm fascinated with those moments when we can take our political differences and trace them to the heartbreak that is beneath them and find common ground there. I'll give you a quick example.
Okay.
Workshops have been done very effectively, bringing together people around very contentious issues like abortion, people who hold different views on those issues. But in the course of a 3-day workshop or weekend retreat, the rule is that not until the last couple of hours can these people tell each other what their positions on the issue are. Instead, they are coached to tell the personal story that took them to the position they hold on the issue. And when you get beneath the position or political commitment and conviction to the personal story, you find two things. You find that the same story, essentially the same story, can lead two people to two different convictions, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you find that those stories share a common element of heartbreak, which is why people are so impassioned about the position that they hold on the issue. But when you spend 2 or 3 days listening not to the arguments that people want to make or the abstract positions they want to lay on each other, but to the stories that lie behind
yes.
their convictions, something new happens, something human happens, a bond is created. It doesn't mean that people immediately change their minds,
mm-hmm.
or maybe ever change their minds. But community is built up that way instead of destroyed. And we find ourselves able to have continuing relationships in which we are able to learn from each other. I have a very simple rule in my life, or lesson from experience, and that is the more you know about another person's story, the less possible it is to distrust, dislike, or hate them.
Isn't that true?
It's absolutely, I think.
And you're speaking of heartbreak. I really do believe, agree with you, that that is at the heart of so much. And to be able to get to the root of that, we do need that community, but also where, and you're an architect of this, the circles of trust.
Right.
Where you can go deep with some of those things.
Right, exactly. I have a chapter that I suppose it's called something like Safe Space for Deep Democracy.
Yes.
And in that I try to lay out several levels of safe space and kinds of safe space. But this gives me a chance to mention just briefly, Richard, the work of the Center for Courage and Renewal, which folks can learn about at www.courage.renewal.org, and learn about the book and learn about the programs we're creating about the book, learn about a webcast that we're doing in October with more to come on these topics. So what we've majored in at the Center for Courage and Renewal over the last 15 years is the creation of circles of trust, which involve 25 people from, let's say, public school teaching or from medicine, from philanthropy, from ministry, sitting together through a series of retreats over a two-year period, maybe 5 to 8 retreats of 3 days each, and creating among themselves, learning how to create among themselves with the help of one of our facilitators, a space that's safe for the soul, which is a way of saying a space in which it's safe to tell our own truth, to acknowledge our own struggles, our own losses, our own suffering, to explore our own hopes and our own gifts, and to do it all in a way that that guarantees there will be no judgment, there will be no advising, there will simply be deep listening. There will be this great thing that a theologian called Nell Morton once said. She said, what we need to do is learn how to hear each other into speech, deeper and deeper speech. And I've had that done for me in my own life. I've had people who listened to me so well and asked honest, open questions that were not efforts to sneak their own agenda in, that weren't advices in disguise, that I was heard into that next layer and that next layer of my own speech, the speech that arises from within, what I call the imperatives of the heart or the imperatives of the soul, that are really the powerful activators of our lives, much more than someone else's advice. I have dozens of stories I could tell about that, but we may not have time for even one of them.
Well, I before we close, I want to make sure that you do share one particular story, because it's near and dear to my heart. We've talked about news. We've talked about, just the noise, I think, that is out there. One of the things that I've been passionate about for activists, call it sacred activism or what I call it social change artist, is the need for the fusion of the inner work of heart with outer service in the world. You have a beautiful section in one of your chapters called Getting the News from Within, and how important that is. Can you tell the story of Thomas Merton?
Oh, I'd love to tell that story. So Thomas Merton was a Trappist monk who spent 27 years, the second half of his life, in the Abbey of Gethsemane down in Kentucky, living really out in the woods in one of the most rigorous forms of monasticism, a silent monastery where they use sign language, lots of solitude, lots of removal from the world. But Thomas Merton was a remarkable man. He was a writer. He was an intellectual. He was profoundly intuitive. He carried on correspondence with very interesting people of his time, including, for example, Martin Luther King Jr. And he sort of kept his ear to the ground by listening to music and by praying and contemplating and searching within himself as a white person living this particular lifestyle. So he wrote a book called Seeds of Destruction, which was published in the early 60s. It followed a book that he'd written a few years earlier called Seeds of Contemplation. Everybody loved Seeds of Contemplation because it was pious.
Yes, yes.
But Seeds of Destruction was a book that prophesied a coming racial conflict in this country. It prophesied the fire next time, to use a famous phrase. And Merton was warning in the early 60s that our cities would be burning, and that it had to do with white racism and the oppression of black people, which had gone on from the very beginning of this country's history. Well, when this book was published, he was taken to task in a public criticism by a wonderful man, actually, named Martin Marty, who is a well-known theologian and a good soul. But Marty believed that Merton didn't know what he was talking about. And Marty, who had been very involved in community organizing and race relations in Chicago, where he lived, basically said, how dare this monk living out in the woods in his comfortable cloister tell those of us who are on the front lines working on this problem that our efforts are for naught, or that, you know, or that something's going to happen that we don't know about. No, that's not going to happen, said Martin Marty. We're working on this thing. Well, a few years later, King is assassinated, the cities are burning, the fire next time has come down upon us, and Martin Marty, who I believe is a great man, wrote a public apology to Thomas Merton, and he said, somehow you, I'll put words in his mouth here, but somehow you, with the inner eye of a monk, and I would also add, with Merton's capacity to honestly and profoundly explore his own psyche as a white man and to get in touch with his own racism, somehow you, Thomas Merton, said Martin Marty, saw what the rest of us couldn't see. Perhaps because the rest of us had our egos invested in the work we were doing and had to believe that our work was going to make all the difference. Perhaps we were blinded by our egos, while you were able to see more deeply into the American situation than we were. And, you know, to me that's an extraordinarily powerful story about getting the news from within. I know that somewhere in that chapter, I think it's the epigraph to that chapter, I have a wonderful quote I'm losing a name here, Bill Moyers, the famous interviews that Bill Moyers did with Joseph Campbell.
Yes.
A wonderful quote from Joseph Campbell from those interviews, where Joseph Campbell says, everybody needs a room in their house or an hour a day where they don't know what's in the newspapers or on the television, and they can get the news from within.
Absolutely.
So he's not saying, you know, don't read or don't listen. He's saying have an alternative news source, and it's inside you right now.
Absolutely. Well, Parker J. Palmer, I have to say, I must have read at least seven of your 9 books. This is my new favorite Parker Palmer book. And thank you for having the courage and taking the time to write this.
Well, thank you for those kind words and for this wonderful opportunity to talk with you. I appreciate your questions very much, and thank you.
Blessings to you.
And you too, Richard.
Again, Parker's website is Courage Renewal, www.politicsweaving.org. Parker wrote in his book, "When we forget that politics is about weaving a fabric of compassion and justice on which everyone can depend, the first to suffer are the most vulnerable among us, our children, the elderly, the mentally ill, the poor, and the homeless. As they suffer, so does the integrity of our democracy." I was thinking about a song from a mutual friend of ours, Carrie Newcomer, "If Not Now, Tell Me When." And Carrie, by the way, will be on the program in a couple of weeks. So I decided in closing this program, we'll go out with that beautiful song from Carrie.
If not now, tell me when. If not now, tell me when. We may never see this moment or place and time again. If not now, if not now, tell me when. I see sorrow and trouble in this land. I see sorrow and trouble in this land. Although there will be struggle, we'll make the change we can. If not now, if not now, tell me when. If not now, tell me when. If not now, tell me when. We may never see this moment, place and time again. If not now, if not now, tell me when. I may never see the promised land. I may never see the promised land. And yet we'll take the journey, and we'll walk it hand in hand. If not now, if not now, tell me when. If not now, tell me when. If not now, tell me. Take a change of heart for this to mend. But miracles do happen, every shining now and then. If not now, if not now, tell me when. If not now,
if not now,
tell me when.
Tell me when.
If not now,
if not now,
tell me when. Tell me when. And miracles do happen, every shining now and then. If not now, if not now, tell me when. If not now, if not now, tell me when.
And that's today's program. Our website is richardbrendan.org. And for associate producer Jerry Curtis, engineer Joe Bainline, and production assistant Pamela Jay, I'm Richard Brendan, and we're bringing love to life one broadcast at a time.